This is Read On Air with Red Zell. For those passionate about books.
Hello and welcome to Read On Air, the show all about books that belongs to you. I'm your host, Red Zell, and this week we're taking a long look at some short stories. Louis de Bernier reveals how his childhood in an English village inspired his notwithstanding stories.
I thought, yes, he's right. Almost everyone was eccentric in some way.
Limmy regales Robert with some daft wee stories.
They weren't due to meet for lunch or anything. She had no idea he was in there, staring at her. If she did, he was quite sure she wouldn't be doing what she was doing.
And the R&IB librarians review some of the great titles on their shelves. That's all coming up in today's show. Louis de Bernier is best known as the author of Captain Corelli's Mandolin, an international bestseller that turned the Greek island of Cephalonia into a tourist destination.
He sat down and wrote, "Cephalonia is a factory that breeds babies for export. There are more Cephalonians abroad or at sea than there are at home. There is no indigenous industry that keeps families together. There is not enough arable land. There is an insufficiency of fish in the ocean. Our men go abroad and return here to die. And so we're an island of children, spinsters, priests, and the very old."
A little less well-known, but just as beautifully written, is Notwithstanding, Stories from an English Village. The collection revolves around the fictional village of the title and its eccentric inhabitants. It's a funny, poignant and wistful portrait of a way of life that has all but vanished. It's one of my favourite books and a collection that I return to again and again.
"I'm not in. Over," I told my mother, sighing, as I held the walkie-talkie in my right hand and with my left continued painstakingly to stick small seeds to the outside of my living room window. "When will you be back? Over," she asked. "Oh, I don't know. Over," I replied. "Well, I hope you're back soon," she said reprovingly. "This is the third time I've walkie-talked and you haven't been there. How am I supposed to talk with my own son if he's never there? Over."
So I'm delighted to be joined by its author, Louis de Bernier. Welcome to Read On Air.
Thank you very much indeed.
So you're best known for your long fiction, which often deals with conflict and the misuse of power. What made you turn to the more personal landscape of a village that's closely related to the one that you grew up in?
It's because I tend to get struck by stories mostly. You know, I'm interested in story more than anything, possibly character second. And I'd never felt that there was anything interesting enough to write about in Britain. I mean, we're mostly sort of quite stable and settled country. But then I went to the south of France to a Salon de Livre quite a long time ago now, and I met a French artist called Jacques who said to me that he just loved England. And I said, "Why?" And he said, "Because it's so exotic." And I was most surprised. I said, "What do you mean?" And he said, "Well, if I go to France or Belgium or Holland or Germany, you know, they just all seem the same." But he said, "L'Angleterre, c'est un asile immense. England is an enormous lunatic asylum." And when I thought about this, and my village where I grew up, I thought, yes, he's right. It's everyone, almost everyone was eccentric in some way. And it's just that for me, it was so normal, I hadn't noticed. So it took this Frenchman to point out how interesting English village life was. And I suspect that village life is actually the same all over the world. I mean, the book has turned out to be quite popular in Greece because the Greeks recognised themselves in it. So that's how it came about. And I had written one or two short stories from the book already, and which have been published in magazines, you know, such as the one I think about the general who stops wearing clothes. And I looked through all of these old short stories I'd written, and I realised I actually did have enough for a collection about the one place. And I wrote a few more to fill it all out. And I've even written one or two after it was published, so that the book is steadily getting bigger.
I was going to ask whether there are more in the pipeline.
There are two more in the latest edition. They're not very long. I mean, one is a really stupid story about a dead dog in a suitcase, and which actually happened around here. And the other story is the memory of when I learnt to drive. I actually learnt to drive backwards before I could drive forwards, because my mother used to let me reverse her Mini out at the garage. And when I started to go forwards, it felt really weird. But, you know, my father had this obsession with building little low brick walls around all the flower beds. And one day I reversed the Mini out of the garage and I knocked over a freshly built wall. And I was so frightened, I fled. And anyway, I've turned this into a short story, which has gone into that, because I suppose I could spoil it for everybody by saying that my dad's building wasn't all that wonderful. And in the story, which is not what happened in real life, the mother character notices that there's a builder next door, and she gets the builder to put the wall up again. And it's when my father sees it, it's twice as nice as what he'd built. And it turns him into a bit of a mystic.
Oh, wonderful. There's a lovely sense of your own personal history that comes through a lot of the stories. I know Silly Bugger, the story about the boy who tames a rook.
Yeah.
I believe there's a photograph of you with a rook on your shoulder.
Yes, I have a rookery in my garden, and every year we bring up the babies, which fall out of the nest. And some of them have been thrown out because they're sick, and they always die. But half of the rest you can actually bring up, and they generally leave in the autumn. But when I was a boy in Hambledon, I brought up a young jackdaw. And jackdaws and rooks are very similar in personality. You know, they're very sociable, very clever, very funny. They knock around together as well. You sometimes get jackdaws making nests in the bottom of rook nests. And so my first experience was with jackdaws rather than rooks. You know, my uncle used to bring up magpies when he was a boy. A lot of us used to do these things. I turned the jackdaw in that story into a rook because I now know rooks a lot better than I know jackdaws. But yes, a lot of this is personal. I mean, for example, it was actually me who caught the great big pike in the Glebe Pond.
Mm.
But I wanted all the stories to be representative of all the people who lived in that village, you know, so I gave that feat to a young lad from the council houses.
And there's a lovely elegiac feel to all the stories. I mean, I get the impression there must have been a Mrs. Rendell who died tragically before her 40th birthday.
Yeah.
And
again, you're quite right, but I mixed things up.
Mm.
So the lovely young blonde woman I remember dying of very young of cancer was called Mrs. Papp, and she didn't own the Glebe House at all. The woman who did own the Glebe House lived to a fairly old age and then dropped dead from a heart attack. What I'm doing is taking real things, muddling them up together.
And also giving them, if not happy endings, giving them very thought-provoking endings. I quite often I find the stories finish just at the height of the emotional impact and leave you to walk away and take what you will from them.
Yeah.
A very different approach to writing a long novel where you will often play that out.
Well, yeah, the point of a novel really is the journey. With short stories, the point is arrival. So it's the same with a poem, actually. A poem and a short story have got to have some sort of a clincher which makes you think, you must never get to the end of a short story or a poem and think, so what?
Mm, mm.
And I've realised that whereas a lot of writers think that their job is to amuse people, I think my job is to move people. And I don't care if I make them cry or if I make them laugh, as long as I get a reaction of some kind. So I try to write things with an emotional impact.
I think you succeed very well. I mean, I've reread the stories in Notwithstanding several times, which is not something I would do with a long novel. Do you set out to write short stories, or are they something that come to you on a whim and you'll sit down and write them as and when?
I'm very much passive in all of this. I I remember listening to Leonard Cohen making a speech in Spain about he felt he couldn't take any credit for the poetry he writes because he's not in charge of it. And I feel I recognize that. Stories and poems and things, they simply turn up and you take advantage of them. I don't think I've ever tried sitting down to write a story when I hadn't thought of one first. Can't imagine it. And very often I fall into a reverie or I have an interesting dream, and that's what turns into a story. So quite often after breakfast I'll just sit down with my eyes closed and just wait for something to arrive. Anyone looking at me would think I was asleep.
And that makes you sound as if you're not one of these disciplined writers who sets out to do 1,000 words a day.
No, I think those people are either liars or they should have been journalists.
Yeah, having worked in journalism, I can tell you exactly, yes. So, and you're a self-confessed lover of instruments. So you find your attention is split between renovating your beloved instruments or old cars or writing? Or do you just go where the whim takes you?
I go where the wind takes me, but the wind takes me in a particular way. So I will get completely obsessed with something for a month or two and then be completely obsessed with something else. And that's how I get things done. At the moment, I am writing every morning because I've got to submit a book last month.
Right.
But in the afternoons, I'm restoring an old Citroen. You know, whereas if you'd asked me a month ago, I would have been mending oboes. It's I'm a bit strange like that. I flit from one obsession to another.
Does that make it difficult to re-inhabit the world of the book, or do you have good recall?
No, because many of my displacement activities give you a lot of quality time for thinking about your writing. Esther Freud once said to me that writers are at work all the time. I scoffed, of course, but as one would. But there is some truth in what she says. You know, you can suddenly be struck with a wonderful idea when you're looking for bread in a supermarket.
And are you a notebook keeper?
I have stacks of notebooks. I try to remember to take one with me wherever I go, and quite often I forget to take one and have to buy another. So I've got dozens of notebooks which are half full. And I mostly, actually, when I'm travelling, write poems in them about the rhythm of train wheels that sort of organises your speech into something musical.
Who are your influences as far as short stories are concerned?
I used to love the ones by Gabriel Garcia Marquez. I've never forgotten one about a dead man who's washed up on the beach, who's so beautiful that all the women fall in love with him. I used to enjoy, you know, Saki's funny stories. Mm. Particularly, I remember that one about the cat who could speak and always spoke the truth. But my philosophy of writing novels is that every chapter is a short story.
Right.
So for me, writing a novel isn't all that different from writing short stories. The only difference is that a chapter doesn't have to have such a good ending as a short story.
We've come on to your novels, and I will not be forgiven unless I mention Captain Corelli's Mandolin. One thing that actually struck me is that Dr. Yanis says in Captain Corelli's Mandolin that history ought to be the anecdotes of the little people who are caught up in it.
I can tell you where my philosophy sort of comes from. It comes from Thomas Hardy, because he wrote about unimportant people getting caught up in things beyond their control, even like Tessa the d'Urbervilles. I'm very, very impressed by the way Thomas Hardy isn't really interested in the kinds of people that other writers write about, like other bloody writers and artists and, you know what I mean?
Mm.
Writers are often rather limited in who they're prepared to write about. They tend to go for people who are somewhat like themselves, and whereas Thomas Hardy did the exact opposite. So I try and write about people who aren't like me. For example, I have no religious faith at all, but I always have people in my novels who do. That's the way I look at it. And notwithstanding, of course, I was greatly helped by the fact that those people are mostly versions of people that I actually do remember. Again, very unimportant people whose lives probably didn't amount to anything very much, but seemed to me too wonderful to forget.
And in Captain Corelli's Mandolin, I know you've been irritated by being compared to Corelli yourself in any other way apart from the fact that you're both music lovers.
Well, I'm not irritated, I'm just amused.
One thing I know that did irritate you quite famously was the film version, which I think you rather pithily said it would be impossible for a parent to be happy with its baby's ears being put on backwards. What was it that most irked you about the film?
Well, you know, oddly enough, people always bring this up, but I said that as a remark, as a generic remark about how writers feel about bad adaptations by filmmakers. Mm-hmm. I didn't actually say that about Captain Crowley's Mandolin.
Oh, right, okay.
And I think the director was, you know, John Madden, has been very sort of saddened by this over the years, and I never had a chance to explain to him that I said that about bad adaptations, not about his adaptation. There were things in the film that did annoy me, like there's a sex scene in an olive grove which completely spoils the story, because at least in the book, part of the sadness of it is that Corelli and Pelagia don't become lovers until they're in old age.
Mm.
There were a few annoying things apart from that, but you know, the cinematography was marvelous, and the soundtrack, I think, was extraordinarily good.
Mm.
There's one song in there, you know, Ricordo Encore, which Russell Watson had a big hit with, which I think is going to last forever. So I'm not as negative about this film as people think. I would have preferred a lively little Italian playing Captain Corelli rather than Nicolas Cage.
That was a strange piece of casting.
Well, you know, I sold it deliberately to a European studio because they didn't want a Hollywood film. And then they think, oh, we can make a Hollywood hit here, and they got him in. So I was subverted in my intention, and I was certainly irritated about that. I was hoping, as I say, for some lively little Italian.
Oh, well, I hope we've managed to put the record straight partly, yeah. Then. So, are you a great consumer of paperback books, or have you turned to electronic media yet?
I'm very averse to reading anything on a screen. It just still annoys me having to write on a computer. So I don't have a Kindle or anything. My publishers tell me that the proportion of hard copy to electronic copy is now completely predictable, so the whole mess has settled down. I think that some bookshops have stopped stocking Kindles and things at all.
Mm.
So I'm still reading hard copy. And as I'm getting older, I have noticed that I much prefer larger print and hard covers. So I'm rather moving away from the little paperbacks we all used to be so fond of. If a book's in very small print, it really puts me off reading it. And I have a theory that the reason that John Milton as a poet isn't greatly appreciated very much anymore is because his Paradise Lost is always printed in tiny, tiny print.
Mm.
And I recently bought a large print copy of it. I thought, my God, this is good stuff.
And do you ever listen to audio versions of books?
I do listen to the versions of my books as I'm driving along in the car, because I want to check on the quality, obviously. Otherwise, in the car, I tend to listen to music or to Radio 4, so I can't say I'm a big consumer of audiobooks. And whenever I got one, I used to pass them on to a blind friend in Bungie who was very appreciative of them.
So you clearly see the importance of the talking book service that the RNIB provides to us.
Yeah, well, this particular gentleman, he's dead now. He was called Sagi Mann, and he was a painter who managed to paint sightlessly. His kinetic sense was just completely extraordinary, and you could tell that he'd done a portrait of his wife, even though he could not see a thing. And Sagi used to listen to my books while he was painting. So he could multitask, you know, and if you want to multitask, an audiobook is a great thing.
I must say I read far more nowadays because, you know, you can do the cooking whilst listening to an audiobook, but
yeah.
Not with a penguin in your hand.
Oh, exactly.
Do you think that you will head back into the territory of writing more short stories?
I am going to have a collection of short stories published soon. I've already sold it. The thing is, I've got stacks and stacks of short stories that I've written throughout my life. And knowing me, when I start working on editing these stories, I will start getting new ideas and write a few more.
Well, Louis de Bernier, thank you very much for joining us on Read On Air.
It's a pleasure. Thank you.
And we'll be hearing more from Louis de Bernier later on. Notwithstanding, read by David Thorpe, is available as TB19191. Many of his novels, including Captain Corelli's Mandolin, and his latest, The Dust That Falls From Dreams, are also available from the RNIB library in a range of formats.
The RNIB Helpline is your direct line to the support and advice you need. Whatever your inquiry, the RNIB helpline team are only a call away with practical and emotional support so you can face the future with confidence. Our friendly, specially trained operators are just a phone call away from 8:45 a.m. and to 5:30 p.m. every weekday. We can help with information on everything you need to know about the RNIB, from eye health, advice on how to volunteer, reading services and loads more, or we can simply offer a listening ear. The RNIB helpline, here for you on 0303 123 9999. That's 0303 123 9999.
You're listening to Read On Air on RNIB Connect Radio, and this week we're checking out some great volumes of short stories. Our wonderful team of RNIB librarians are a dedicated lot. Every month, they select a genre to mug up on. Each librarian picks a title available in all three accessible formats, reads it, and gives a short review to the rest of the team at their next meeting. That way, they pool their knowledge and can guide us better to the books that we want to read. Last month, they tackled short stories, and we were allowed to eavesdrop.
Hello, this is Andrew in the Reader Services team at the RNIB Library, and I read Nocturnes by Kazuo Ishiguro. This is a set of five longer short stories, I would say. They're about an hour each when I listen to them. They're on a theme, they're connected by music being the theme. There are musicians in each of the stories, or people's love of music, or that sort of thing, or a particularly distinctive piece of music appears in the background of each story. The first one is about a young man who is in a number of sort of bands in St. Mark's Square in Venice, and he sees someone who's a famous singer. He goes over, is very much a fan of this famous singer, and tells him how wonderful he thinks he is. And then he agrees to go with this singer to serenade the singer's wife from a gondola later that evening. When they go and do this, the chap's wife bursts into tears. And when we ask why he's burst into tears, this then leads to a twist at the end of the story. The following stories include one that's very farcical, one that involves a young musician who goes to stay with friends as a singer-songwriter to work on his songs, and a strange couple he meets who come into their cafe. There is the wife who appears in the first story, reappears in another story where she's staying in a hotel after having had plastic surgery, and she meets a young musician who's also having plastic surgery. He's been persuaded to do that to get on in his career. And they kind of go and cause mischief within the hotel. There's a final story about a cellist who is taken on by a female fan who coaches him to become a better cellist, although can she actually play the cello herself, or is she just a very good coach and knows how to bring him on? So they're an interesting mixture of stories. I was kind of drawn in by the first story and confused by the second one, and then kind of felt like I was a bit disappointed with the other ones. I came away from the stories thinking they're all right, but they're not actually anything particularly amazing. And this is from someone who was a prize-winning author with some of his other work. I came away thinking they were pretty inoffensive and mainstream, and something if you just wanted something gentle to listen to in the background, but certainly not something that I would go out of my way to recommend.
Hi, this is Joe from the Reader Services team at the RNIB Library. I read Breakfast at Tiffany's, which is paired with three other shorter stories by Truman Capote. Obviously, Breakfast at Tiffany's and the story of Holly Golightly is a very famous and well-known story due to the movie of the same name. Although I enjoyed all four stories, maybe this was the reason I enjoyed the three others more. Perhaps my mind strayed too much towards Audrey Hepburn and George Peppard with the song Moon River from the film running through my head. Having never read Truman Capote before, and perhaps influenced by being aware of his classic true crime story In Cold Blood, I was expecting something darker, that was pleasantly surprised at the charming and touching stories in this collection. The first of the shorter stories is House of Flowers, the tale of a young prostitute in Haiti finding true love and happiness with a boy from the mountains. The second, titled A Diamond Guitar, explores the nature of friendship and longing for times past in the tale of a long-term prisoner's friendship with a younger inmate, the player of the guitar in the title, who later escapes. The third, and possibly my favourite, is A Christmas Memory, which tells the story of the relationship between a seven-year-old and their much older relative as they prepare for and enjoy Christmas together, baking cakes, finding a tree and cutting it down, and making presents for each other. I guess it's a sign of a great writer that subjects that could drift into being saccharine sweet are merely touching and poignant, and remind the reader, at least in my case, of their own similar experiences. I really enjoyed this collection.
I'm Julie Gibson. I work in the library as Library Engagement Manager. And this month I read four stories by Alan Bennett. All of the stories hang around the interpretation of relationships between people, sometimes between families, sometimes between strangers or people who've met. And often relationships change throughout the stories. The first one, it's the four, was called The Laying On of Hands. And it's set in a church in the middle of someone's funeral. It's very interesting how we can read not only what people are saying, but what they're thinking as well. And everyone else is sitting there thinking, no one else is aware of the relationship they had with the deceased who's lying in the coffin at the front of the church. And it turns out that they all had quite a deep relationship with the person that they thought no one else knew about, and we're all experiencing the same thing. I won't explain what it is, but it includes the clergyman as well, so I'll let you make of that one what you will. The second story is called The Clothes They Stood Up In, and it tells the story of Mr. and Mrs. Ransom, who are very kind of upper middle class. They've got a very comfortable lifestyle. Mr. Ransom is all about the impression they give to other people and how things should be done very properly. Mrs. Ransom's been swept along on this little wave throughout their marriage, and has just kind of tolerated it, although she didn't agree with everything. So the story starts when they're coming back from the opera one evening, and Mr. Ransom's had a marvellous time. Mrs. Ransom's kind of, you know, just generally enjoyed it to some extent, but takes it on as a kind of another activity of her husband's choice. And they get home. Their house has been completely stripped of all its interior. All the furniture, every possession they had has gone. Even the carpets have been taken out. Light bulbs, curtain rings and light fittings. And so they spend the rest of the night in this empty house. There's a really funny bit where Mr. Ransom needs to go to the loo and finds that the toilet paper has been stolen, and ends up ironically using the opera program as toilet paper, which is great hardship to him. And the story moves on around how they deal with the burglary and they move on from it. And their relationship with each other changes. And their relationship with their lives changes as well. So they kind of end up in opposite positions. The third story of the three is called Father, Father, Burning Bright. This is about an old gentleman who's lying, dying in hospital from kind of old age type illnesses. And his son is rushing off to see his father. He's a school teacher and has always been a bit of a disappointment to his father. So has a very hot and cold relationship with him, but of course feels responsible for how the family deals with everything and is trying to plan funeral and what is he going to do. He doesn't know what to do about the situation. And then his aunt and his uncle arrive separately to the hospital where he's pacing the floor. The aunt is very melodramatic and keeps repeating, "Oh, I always thought I'd go first." She wants all the attention. She's trying to grab the attention from the dying man. And her brother turns up later, who's much more pragmatic about everything and realistic. And the relationship between those three in all of those directions is very dynamic and changing rapidly. It's a bit more of a kind of realistic story. I think these situations often happen in families, and it's very, very observant. The final one of the four will probably be recognised by many people, and it's the original writing of The Lady in the Van. And this is a true story. It's actually part of Alan Bennett's life. Miss Shepherd, the lady in the van, arrived in his street when he lived in a particular street in London, and eventually moved onto his drive in her dilapidated old camper van. And she stayed there for well over a decade. She didn't have a toilet in the van, so that was quite an interesting situation. But the dynamic between the two of them is absolutely incredible. He has massive respect for Miss Shepherd, whilst being very irritated by her, but doesn't have the heart to move her on and feel somewhat responsible for her. And Maggie Smith has covered the role of Miss Shepherd three times now, from when it was first performed on radio through to doing it live on stage, and also the film, which was recently released. I think it was shown on terrestrial television at Christmas. Absolutely marvellous interpretation and very true to the story. So these four stories all have very different moods. There's a lot of laughter. There's quite a bit of tragedy in there. Alan Bennett is really good at putting forward the many different sides of relationships. And you can be laughing your head off in 1 minute and then in tears the next about the same situation. He's a very, very clever writer. I may be biased, he is my favourite writer, and that was an excuse I used to read this one, really. But I'd thoroughly recommend it to lots of different reading preferences. Lots of different people would get something from this. It's got a bit of romance in it, it's got a bit of family disagreement and tragedy, it's got a bit of light relief. So I'd recommend it to anybody.
Plenty of food for thought there. Thank you to Andrew, Joe and Julie, and we'll be hearing more from the team later in the show. Do you have a favourite book in the library that you'd like to review? Or maybe you've written a short story that you'd like to share? Why not drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you.
Love books? Well, RNIB Library has a world of books and loads more reading for you to enjoy. And you can choose from Braille, giant print, and talking books. For more info, head to rniblibrary.com or call our expert team on 0303 123 9999. RNIB Library, here for all your reading needs.
You're listening to Read On Air, your one-stop shop for book news, reviews, and author interviews. It wasn't so long ago that comedian Limmy was on the show giving us an exclusive preview of his new book of short stories, That's Your Lot. And here he is talking to Robert Kirkwood about his first collection of Daft Wee Stories.
Available commercially now in audio and in print is Daft Wee Stories by Limmy.
He woke up, face down in the dirt of the dusty Nevada desert. He got to his feet and brought his horns to his eyes to shield him against the midday sun. He couldn't remember passing out. He couldn't remember a thing.
Hello, my name's Brian Limond, otherwise known as Limmy, and I'm the writer of Daft Wee Stories.
Nae sounds of insects, nae cars in the distance, nae birds in the sky, nothing. He didn't know how he got there or how to get out, but he did know that one thing. He was in trouble. Suddenly, he was hit in the face with a wet teabag.
You can guess with the title. It's got lots of Daft Wee Stories in it. It's about 70 stories, about 1,000 words each on average. Some are like tiny wee stories, just about one line long. And some are quite big ones. But I have lots of Daft Wee Stories, believe it or not.
Now, I've just produced you doing the audio version, and I noticed a lot of the stories are very dark. Is it more of a horror book than a comedy book?
Well, I kind of like sort of horror comedy. I don't mean like in a, what do you call it, you know, the kind of Shaun of the Dead or American Werewolf in London sense, but I do find dark things funny. I've got a kind of dark sense of humour, so I do like it when people are being kind of scared or horrified or something like that. Not in real life, just in stories. So they're sort of like horror stories in it, but it's funny when I wrote the stories, then I'm sort of ordering them, putting them in order in the book. There'd be one story that's that ends with somebody getting seriously hurt, and the next one it ends with somebody getting seriously hurt, and another one where somebody gets seriously hurt. So I did notice there was a wee bit of a kind of habit I've got. I must be a bit of a sadist, but it's no full of people getting hurt. There's one or two where somebody doesn't get hurt. See if you can find it.
And a few people being hit by trains.
That's right. I think I had about maybe three or four stories where somebody got hit by a train. It isn't funny in real life, right? But I mean, in stories, I find it funny. But I had lots of people getting hit by trains, or like quite a lot of people getting hit by a bus. So I'd sort of chop up a wee bit, right, we'll have him get hit with a train. That's three people getting hit by a train. I'll have one getting hit by a bus. I'll have one, I don't know if I did actually find anything else. I think quite a lot are just either gone under trains or under buses.
Oh, that's really nice, said Janice, looking at the top. You going to get a bigger size or get something else? I might get something else, said Tracy. I've already got a top like it anyway. I don't know why I got it. Just think I fancied grabbing something. Janice's scalp began to tear open.
So who are your literary influences?
Well, the funny thing is I don't really have a lot, because I'm no, even though I've wrote this book, I'm no much of a reader myself. I think I only started reading, like after school, I was obviously reading in school, but it was about 10 years later till I actually picked up a book of my own accord. I actually went into a bookshop and bothered doing it, and I think it was Stephen King Needful Things, I think, I got, or I think it was like short stories after somebody, Stephen King. So after that, I just thought, well, I'll stick with him. And I just, it was Stephen King. I don't know how much I'm influenced by him, but I really liked that, and just a few of the wee sort of classics and everything, you know, like 1984 and all the rest of it. But I don't know, I don't really feel influenced.
Because there's a vibe in the book that reminds me, not so much of the story, but of the mood of the story, by Stephen King, called The Moving Finger.
Aye, that's right. I remember you saying, it's funny, there's one story that's kind of like that. There's a guy that's in a toilet and something bad happens. And I have definitely read that story in the past, The Moving Finger. You know, the short story collection. It was in, I can't remember, what, I think it was Nightmares and Dreamscapes.
Nightmares and Dreamscapes, yeah.
Because I've definitely read the lot of that, but I couldn't remember it, you know, when I was writing it. I wasn't like that here. I think I'll just rip off Stephen King and there we go. Just slam it in and give him the credit. But, I mean, I love stuff like that, like kind of Twilight Zone stuff where just something happens. Just something happens and that's that. You know, something strange. Because in The Moving Finger, I think it's, I think we were speaking before about it, you said it's this finger that just comes out of bath. In mine, there's something behind the tiles on the wall when he's on the toilet. So it's kind of similar in that, but I think I've seen other things to almost kind of defend myself. No, I mean, there's plenty of stories like that where something like that happens.
Do you feel you sometimes needed to put a joke at the end of some of the tales rather than just leave them as is?
I do like putting jokes at the end of stuff. I mean, people can watch, because I like Lemmy Show, people can watch Lemmy Show and go, but there aren't any jokes in Lemmy Show. No, not even so much. Like, they could still find it funny, but there isn't a joke in it. There isn't much of, well, there's sort of punchlines in Lemmy Show and everything, but because I come from a comedy background, I want to try and be funny. Even if I'm trying to make a serious point, I like making a bit funny then, because I've still got Lemmy Show in my mind. If I was to put some kind of serious point or something like that in Lemmy Show and it just ended like that, you know, people would be going, yeah, it's rubbish. You have failed. This is meant to be a comedy show. You failed, that sketch failed. So I'm always trying to be a bit funny, but I have been reading lots of short stories since writing the book, and I've been noticing no Stephen King ones, these other ones that I've seen recommended and everything, and it's amazing, it's not amazing, but the way they end, they don't really... Obviously, they don't end with punchlines and things like that. Like, with horror stuff. That's all right when that ends, but it seems you've just got a story, it's just a kind of normal story, and it's thoughtful, and then it just ends. You know, I remember reading, I want to say who, you know, but I was reading one story, and it's that way that you get to the end of the story, you turn the page, oh, wait a minute, it's the next story now.
Mm.
You know, it's just like films where it's, boom, goes to black, and you're waiting for it to fade from black to the next scene. Now it's the credits. Hey, wait a minute. No, he's like, don't tell me that's it. Not that they're disappointing, it's just that I'm no used to that sort of thing, you know, like these stories just ending with nothing.
And we talked about literary, but what are your comedy influences?
I'm not really sure. I like weird stuff. I like, there's a lot of kind of normal stuff that I like Laurel and Hardy and all that. It's funny, there's lots of things that I like. If I've been asked this sort of thing, it's kind of like if somebody asks you with music and all, you feel obliged to give sort of interest and sort of replies, but in fact, you kind of like really normal stuff, like Harry Hill or something like that. You know, I like Harry Hill, but I'm not pure influenced by Harry Hill, but that's something that when it was on Harry Hill, I think it was the Harry Hill show, I can't remember, but I used to love that. I love things like that, a bit of Monty Python, and like the day-to-day, all the old sort of Amando Iannucci influence stuff and all these sort of things, but I kind of like things that are not really supposed to be funny, stuff that's actually serious, but I find it funny, which is a bit like going back to getting hit by buses and trains that we're talking about. Know that I'm actually there at a train crash, gutting myself, but dark stuff.
Thanks, said Tracy, as Janice turned to walk away. Oh, by the way, Janice turned back. What? Tracy took a step towards Janice, lowering her voice to a whisper. Your face fell off.
So did the Terry Gilliam animations in Monty Python have anything to do with your early Flash animations?
I loved all the wee animations that you get, and I loved the whole lot of, Monty Python and the Holy Grail. I liked that, but I also liked all the wee animations and his style and the kind of the sun or the moon or whatever it was, sort of jumping up and down and going down the stairs. And I loved them. There's one sketch called, Confuse a Cat. And I think this cat's got like depression or something like that, or it's just sort of lazy. It's sort of sitting about, not really doing much. And they get this sort of service out called Confuse a Cat, because they think, well, if you just confuse your cat, then it'll snap out of it. And then it's obviously this probably Terry Gilliam directed sort of thing, where it's almost like it's like kind of stop motion animation only with them, just doing all these different things and turning into seals and jumping about and then disappearing. And I love a lot of wee things like that.
So finally, why should somebody buy the print or the audio version of Daft Wee Stories?
Because we live in a very busy time. Hardly got a minute to pick up a book and read it for 3 weeks or something. This is ideal if you want to pick up your book or listen to audiobook. You just want to listen to one story at a time, and it only lasts for a minute or 2 minutes or 5 minutes. And then you can get back to whatever it was you're doing. It's perfect for the Twitter generation, for the don't have a time type of people out there.
Ian held his spoon of tomato soup an inch from his mouth, motionless, as he stared out the cafe window with his jaw on the deck. Outside, at the other side of the road, was his ma. There she was. They weren't due to meet for lunch or anything. She had no idea he was in there, staring at her. If she did, he was quite sure she wouldn't be doing what she was doing.
Lemmy, reading from his book Daft Wee Stories, available in print and in audio wherever books or audiobooks are sold.
Thanks to Robert and Lemmy. As Robert says, Daft Wee Stories is available commercially, but Lemmy's latest collection, That's Your Lot, can be found in the RNIB library as TB701898. Just go to rniblibrary.com or call the Action Line on 0303 123 9999 and select option 5. Now it's back to the librarians for a final perusal of the short story shelves.
Hello, My name's Tracy and I work in the Reader Services team, and today I'm reviewing The Return Journey by Maeve Binchy. It's a book of short stories which are really, really very lovely. There's quite a few in each book. I started off actually reading a different book called This Year Will Be Different, which turned out to be Christmas stories, which it's April. I didn't really want to read Christmas stories in April. So I moved on to The Return Journey. Really lovely, very little back of books, back of stories even. Starts off with some quite nice ones and then some quite funny ones and some that you could describe as being missed opportunity ones. For example, there's one called The Wrong Suitcase, where people get the wrong suitcase. One person reads the diary of the person in the wrong suitcase. The other person reads the business notes of... They both realise that actually they're not great people. Doesn't necessarily go the way you'd expect. Then you follow on with Miss Vogel's Vacation, which is a really lovely little story about somebody who always puts other people first but ends up getting their reward and happiness. So all in all, a little nice story for everybody. I've had a lovely week reading these stories. They've been really pleasant, and I highly recommend it to anybody who wants a little bit of something nice, a little bit of something funny, a little bit of something that's maybe a little heartstrings. So I would recommend this to anybody.
I'm Wendy Webb. I work in the Reader Services Department as a library administrator. I read A Quiver Full of Arrows by Geoffrey Archer, and I found this to be a very easy read. The stories were quite simple, and each one was set in a different place and during a different time period. Some of the countries that you get to visit, you know, throughout the book are China, Brazil, Nigeria, Israel, New York, and Hungary. Stories set in these different places actually added interest because you kind of got a glimpse of life during that time. And the stories cover different scenarios, such as a lunch date, a collector's Ming vase, two competitive students, a backgammon game, broken routine, and a coup in Nigeria. So those are just some of the stories that are covered in the book. The one that I enjoyed was called The Hungarian Professor. So obviously that was set in Hungary, and it's about 8 years after the Hungarian Revolution, when a young man travels with other students to Budapest to take part in athletic games. And he loses the race that he's in, because he's in the 100 metres race. And so because he loses quite early on in the competition, he has to sit the rest of the competition throughout the week on the sidelines. So he watches the tournament, really. And after a couple of days of watching the tournament on the side, a gentleman approaches him and says to him, "Are you English?" And he says, "Yes." And he introduces himself as an English professor at a university there in Hungary. And so he starts talking to him about England, because he says he loves England. And so they're discussing different parts of England, buildings, libraries, things like that. And the young man actually feels embarrassed that he doesn't know as much about England or London as this elderly gentleman does. So they get chatting, and then the elderly gentleman invites him to his home for a meal. So he goes a couple of nights later, and he cooks him a meal, and they get chatting again about politics to do with Britain and sorts of things like that. And then the young man actually realises how comfortable he feels in his company. And at the end of the evening, he gives the professor a long handshake and says, "Oh, sorry to go, but if you're ever in London again, please come and see me. I'd love to take you to a cricket match in Lord's and to meet my family." So the professor looks a bit sad, and he says, "Well, what's the matter?" And he says, "Well, I've never ever been out of Hungary in my whole life." And the young man's surprised, because he knows so much. He says, "Well, why?" He says, "Well, when I was younger, I was too young and I couldn't afford it. and now with the situation in Hungary, I'm not able to leave. So the young man is really surprised and saddened that he didn't get to fulfill his dreams. And then after a little while of returning to England, he reads in the professor's obituary in the newspaper and realizes that he's it's very true that he didn't actually get to meet him again. So it's just a story of missed opportunities and dreams, really. And that's kind of the essence of all the stories. They've got a message in them. So all the stories that make you think, they make you smile, they can create a feeling of being disappointed, proud, and things like that. So if you really want to travel without leaving your sofa, it would be a good book to read. The stories are very easy, as I said. Geoffrey Archer creates scenes really well so that you can picture them in your mind and follow the story. So I think it would actually suit anybody, really, young or old. And because the stories are quite short, you can read them in one sitting and leave the rest for another time. So that's my review wrapped up.
It's Edwina from Reader Services, and I was reading Mum and Mr. Armitage, a selection of short stories by Beryl Bainbridge. This is an unusual collection of 12 short stories, which I wouldn't recommend to someone who wants a light, enjoyable read. Most of the stories focus on an element of human nature and of a main character who's not aware of an important part of what's going on and therefore misses the point regarding what has really happened. When this isn't the case, the stories involve death or dying. Some of the stories kept coming back to me after I'd finished them and left me with a lot of unanswered questions. The tennis one, for example, did leave me wondering what actually happened to the missing character who goes off to get an escaped tennis ball and never returns. A thought-provoking read, and the fact I kept thinking about some of them shows they did have more of an impact than I thought at the time. But I can't say that I found them humorous.
Short and sweet, like a good short story. Thanks to Tracy, Wendy and Edwina. And we'll be dropping in on the librarians again next month when they review another genre. Have you found a hidden gem in the library that you'd like to share? Drop us a line by emailing readonair@rnib.org.uk. We'd love to hear from you. Now it's back to Louis de Bernier for the books of his life. So, Louis, was there a book that you read as a young man that made you think, I've got to become a writer?
Yes, it was The Cruel Sea by Nicholas Montserrat. The Cruel Sea is about the Atlantic convoys in the Second World War. And it is quite Hardy-esque in that it's about just people caught up in a conflict, just ordinary people, and finding themselves in extraordinary circumstances, you know, escorting merchant ships whilst being hunted by German submarines. And it's a book that taught me how to write about violence without making it seem glamorous. Very important lesson.
This is the story, the long and true story, of one ocean, two ships, and about 150 men. It's a long story because it deals with a long and brutal battle, the worst of any war. It has two ships because one was sunk and had to be replaced. It has 150 men because that's a manageable number of people to tell a story about. Above all, it's a true story because that's the only kind worth telling.
Is there a book that on a rainy day you'd curl up with on the settee and happily reread?
I think it would be Madame Bovary by Flaubert. I've always loved that book. Emma Bovary is in some ways a sort of irritating and misguided character who gets everything wrong, but I feel the most immense sympathy for her, dealing with the terrible boredom of her provincial life. I think Flaubert was very good at making us feel sympathetic for this unsympathetic character. It has a lot in common with Anna Karenina, actually, which is also about a discontented married woman. And that's another book I would love to curl up with again and just read from cover to cover.
We were in big school when the head came in, followed by a new boy in ordinary day clothes and by one of the juniors carrying a large desk. Those of us who were asleep woke up and we all rose to our feet, doing our best to give the impression that we'd been interrupted in the midst of our labours. The head made a sign to us to be seated, then turning to the usher on duty, Monsieur Roger, he he said in a low voice. I am putting this boy in your charge. He will start in the 5th. Later, should his work and general conduct warrant promotion, he will be moved into the senior class, where at his age he ought to be. The new boy had withdrawn so completely into the corner behind the door as to be scarcely visible. He was a country lad, about 15 years of age, and a good deal taller than any of the rest of us. He wore his hair cut in a straight fringe on his forehead like a village choir boy. He looked solemn and very shy. Though he was not particularly broad in the shoulders, his green cloth jacket with its black buttons seemed to irk him uncomfortably under the arms, and a pair of red wrists, accustomed to exposure, showed through the openings in his cuffs. His legs, encased in blue stockings, emerged from yellowish trousers braced very high. On his feet he wore heavy, badly polished shoes, studded with nails.
And finally, is there a book that you've read recently that you'd like to share with the audience because you've loved it so much?
Yes, I'm totally enthusiastic about a young writer from London called Gemma Wayne. I met her recently at King's Lynn Festival, and she's written two books so far, and they're both absolutely extraordinary. One is called Chains of Sand, and it's about, really, Israel. It's about how Palestinians and Jews are coping with life in Israel, really, and how some of them just want to leave, but how some people want to go there from London and become Israelis. It's a very complicated book. I mean, it's really wonderful. And the other book she's written is called After Before, which I think is just as good. What Gemma does is take three stories, and sort of like a trident, that come into one story at the end.
There was comfort in the uniformity of floor upon floor of council housing, like that of the building she lived in, her room on the 5th indistinguishable from the rest. There was tranquility in the busyness of people's lives, in their individualistic pursuits and their self-obsession. There was isolation, escape.
Louis de Bernier, thank you so much for sharing your love of reading with me and the audience, and I look forward to your next book.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Thanks to Louis, and if you'd like to share the books of your life, why not email us at the usual address, readonair@rnib.org.uk. So, that's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to Louis de Bernier, Limmy, and the wonderful RNIB Library team. Read On Air will be back at the same time next week. But if you can't wait that long, you can find all our past shows, complete with some exclusive author interviews, book reviews and more, on our Audioboom page. Simply head to audioboom.com and search for RNIB, where you'll find Read On Air and other great content from RNIB Connect Radio. So until next week, thanks for listening, and remember to read on.